Committee on Environment and Land Use. Our apologies for being a little late, but we will start. We're going to begin the public hearing on House Bill 2137 at approximately 9:15. So those of you that are primarily here for that, in the meantime, we're trying to close up the invited testimony for the committee's benefit between now and 9:15. So we'll open with Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. The representative is here, and he is. Okay. And I will just gavel to say we're opening the informational part of our meeting. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Good morning. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Bolio. I'm state geologist. I'm real good at math when I know all the numbers, so if you have X number of people between now and 9:15, what is that, four? Then I'll know how much time to spend. How much time would you like me to spend this morning?
I would say somewhere between 5 and 10 minutes.
Okay, very good.
You could do that, John.
I can. I always have a long version and a short version. I give people their choice.
We'll go to the Reader's Digest
version. This is the Reader's Digest version. Okay. With that in mind, you have four items that have been distributed to you. Very, very briefly, the Oregon Department of Geology is in place to develop and to disseminate information that's useful to the people in the communities of Oregon, and also to regulate the natural resource side of aggregate, metals, stone, industrial minerals, oil, gas, geothermal energy. My five-member board receives information from the public, has public meetings around the state, and also serves as the Oil and Gas Commission for the state of Oregon. We recently have been asking ourselves how best we serve the needs of Oregon, and have produced the so-called strategic plan which you have in front of you for the years 2003 through 2009. It emphasizes field presence, partnering, public service, objectivity, and proper priorities. We were happy to get this in place 6 months or a year early because it sure helped us get through five special sessions, and it'll probably help us get through this regular session. When my board put that together, they realized they had some unfinished business, and they produced this blue sheet that's also in front of you. And that's merely a statement that says, in a support role, our agency should spend a little more time and emphasis on the development of meaningful geologic information as it relates to the water resources of the state, and that we should work very closely with the lead water agencies and just simply help them do a better job with better information. I can give examples of that later if yes. People have interest there. Finally, there's a one-pager saying that this sheet is basically stating a few things about the department, what our priorities are. They are economic and safety benefits for the citizens, environmental benefits, regulatory benefits and services, which are tailored to the conditions as we find them in the field. Not necessarily, they meet all standards, but they are not necessarily arbitrarily applied out of some central office. And then finally, we're there just to help when help is needed. Quite often we partner, and that involves the sharing of resources and funding or whatever. And then finally, I think the main interest of the committee this morning is to know what kind of policy calls might be coming up before the committee this session. So that's my final handout, and I'll just very briefly go through these so that perhaps if they trigger a question, I can respond to those in the time allowed. We are looking for a small fee increase in the mining area that is supported by industry, and it comes after 6 years of no increases and our holding of positions vacant for lack of revenue just to fund our authorized positions. There also is a need for better maps around mine sites. Most of our problems involve miners creeping over the boundary line and impacting neighbors, and if they are required to provide us with better maps, then they're probably less apt to get into trouble. And I look at the list, we have six other things. The first one involves there are different ways to do contracting for fixing old mine sites with pulled bonds. Let's say a mining operator goes out of business, leaves the state or whatever. We have a bond that allows us to go in and fix that site But if we have to deal with a whole bunch of paper and treat it as a public works contract, much as you would a courthouse or something, we cannot get in there in a timely way and fix something before the environment's hurt. So we did have a legislative concept in that said, let us try a different contracting method. Frankly, I don't know where that concept is, because it fell off the track somewhere, but I've been told it's alive and well somewhere. We're a little concerned about the Endangered Species Act, not necessarily for or against it, but it seems like there are ways to work with the federal agencies that are effective and efficient. We've had a number of parties, other state agencies and industry, asking us if we can work a little more closely with the federal agencies and find better ways to meet their needs. My board is going to start pursuing that possibility at its next meeting. There may be legislative need attached to that if we don't have the authorities that people think we need. I've already mentioned geologic data for water. Geology basically tells water where to go and how to get there. So if we have good geology maps, it helps the water agencies understand the resource that they're managing. 4 years ago, in 1999, Senate Bill 12 came through the legislature and prescribed various ways of dealing with rapidly moving landslides throughout the state. In 1996 and 97, we had about 20 or 30,000 of those, and they killed a number of people. There was legislative interest. Senate Bill 12 at that time said that the responsibility was to be a shared responsibility, involving to some extent foresters, to some extent communities, to some extent the private citizen, each doing their job. We were, as an agency, to produce some maps of where those areas were. Well, we produced the maps and learned that when those maps hit the street, they triggered a 10-month moratorium on all construction. So we pulled the maps back, and now the Legislative Interim Committee on Land Use or something like that has taken a great interest in this, and we presented information to them. There may be motion this session to change some of the policy calls in Senate Bill 12. For example, possibly the moratorium, and there also is a need for us to complete our maps, and we don't have resources for that, and they'll be touching on that as well. Senator Farioli was sort of the lead during the interim. And finally, Measures 15 and 16 prescribed, or they didn't prescribe anything, they enabled the legislature to start a bond program to address the need for seismic rehabilitation of some buildings in the state. We had demonstrated in the prior two session that the next large subduction zone earthquake will cause a minimum of $12 billion in damage. There's a strong interest in the state to fix that. The voters said, yeah, we'll give the legislature ability to bond for that. My agency is not for or against that effort, but we're involved in it, I guess. So there might be interest this session for a bonding measure to look at the seismic rehab costs for the state of Oregon. Okay, those are the key points. We have a strategic plan. Our thrust is field presence and scientific objectivity. Quite often we are in a support role to other agencies that are lead, but our work is quite important to them if they're to do their job well. And we have a couple of issues coming up this session which I just described to you. I'll be happy to respond to questions.
John, and again, I apologize because this is not an area that we do want to skirt over lightly. We do have issues, and these are very important issues. And again, I apologize for having to ask you to condense this morning, but I do hope you'll come back and speak with us again.
Be happy to. Thank you very much.
Any questions from the committee? Thank you, Jim.
Could you?
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Could you explain a little bit how your maps stop development?
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, the way Senate Bill 12 was constructed, our responsibility was to develop some maps called further review area maps for rapidly moving landslides. Which areas of Western Oregon on a map would local government have to require a site-specific report in before construction could occur in that area, because we had determined that it seemed to have a reasonable threat for rapidly moving landslide. Elsewhere in the Act was a paragraph that said, basically it said, when Dogami's maps are officially released and hit the street, there is a 10-month moratorium on all construction in those areas. Now, there are different theories as to why that was put in there. I think it was put in there to prompt local government to pass an ordinance of some kind to deal with the issue. But nonetheless, it becomes a moratorium if we use the word further review area map. Now, for clarification, we had put our maps out on the street in draft form for comment, and the comments come back. And based on the comments and also on some feedback from the Legislative Interim Committee, which we had approached because we saw this issue developing, we pulled the maps back and said, these maps are not officially published yet. They were only draft for comment, and people didn't like how the rest of the bill played out.
Mr. Chair, could we ask for copies of those draft maps, at least for Washington and Multnomah County?
John, can we do that?
You can, if I could clarify for a moment. The maps that we made, if I were to make, they're in the computer, and if I were to make one set of those maps, would be a set of 500 quadrangles about 2 feet deep at a cost of about $2,000 or $3,000.
But what I, inflexible computer
system, what I can do is go back and find out a way to print maps, was it Washington and
Multnomah County?
Washington and Multnomah County at a different scale or something.
That'd be great.
And get those back to you. And again, those were further review areas. They were not pinpointed as this is a bad area. They were areas like there may be a bad one in here somewhere.
And please, if I may, Mr. Chair, say that I don't want to cause a $2,000 to $3,000 expense on the basis of this
really
curiosity.
I was really hoping you'd say that.
Right? Yeah. Maybe $20 worth.
Yeah. And if I could make one further comment, it's our belief, it's our commitment, I guess, if we could go into phase two of our mapping, which would be to look harder at these polygons which you will receive, and do a more rigorous analysis from an engineering standpoint and more field work, that the polygons that you will receive in the maps you'll see will be much, much smaller and less numerous in a final set of further review area maps if we're allowed to make such a set. So I will give you a set of what's preliminary and draft now and bring it to you, and we'll talk about it if you'd like. Okay.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you,
very good.
John, very much this morning. Oregon Farm Bureau, Don Schellenberg. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Good morning, Donald.
I'm Don Schellenberg, Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau. Harkening back to last week's hearing and testimony that I heard there, there was a number of people who indicated that we ought to have a greater focus on urban planning, and that we've spent a lot of time on agricultural planning in the last number of years, but now we ought to be focused on urban planning. And we don't have any quarrel with that. We certainly believe that there should be the efficient use of land inside the urban growth boundary. We do disagree, however, that we've done a good job on the rural planning, and that somehow all of agriculture's land use problems have been resolved, and we can forget about them now and go on and do something else. One of the core principles of land use planning is that of prevention of conflict. And you know, we've experienced that for years inside the cities. That's why we don't have manufacturing plants in residential zones, is because we've had planning and we separate those uses so that they don't conflict with one another. Only recently have we applied that concept outside the cities. I say recently, 1973, when we began our land use planning, statewide land use planning system, where we applied that concept outside the urban growth boundary, outside the city, and provided that we would have exclusive farmers zones, and that's where farming would occur, and you could do that out there without upsetting the general public with your normal farming practices. When we did that and established our statewide land use planning system, we allowed 7 permitted and conditional uses inside those manufacturing walls, as it were. Agriculture actually is no different than a manufacturing plant, except that we don't have any walls around our manufacturing plant. But when we did the land use planning, again, we allowed seven permitted conditional uses inside the FU zone. 25 years later, we now allow 50 permitted and conditional uses inside the farm use zone. So we don't believe that particularly good job has been done, as someone suggested, and that there is still work to do. One of the major Farm Bureau concerns that we have is the viability of the agricultural infrastructure. Now, in the cities, we know what the infrastructure is. We've all talked about that. We know what the importance of it is. But very few people outside of agriculture ever think about the fact that there is, in fact, an agriculture infrastructure as well, and an infrastructure that needs to be protected. And even though in the agriculture community we talk about the agricultural infrastructure, we've never really defined it. We talk about the agricultural infrastructure in an agricultural community, and we haven't determined what the size of the agricultural community is either. Is it just a small area around a city? Is it countywide, or is it statewide? Is it national, or is it even international in today's day and age? And so recently, begin several years ago, but through the Oregon Agricultural Education Foundation, Oregon State University, in conjunction with American Farmland Trust, and at our invitation and asking, conducted a study to determine those two questions, what the answer to those two questions were. The result of that study, the pilot study has just been completed. We haven't actually got the final report in our hand yet, but we got a preview of it the other day by OSU, and what they in fact did was create a computer program that allows policymakers to assess what is determine, what is the agricultural infrastructure, how big is the agriculture community, and what is the impact of making land use decisions on the agricultural community and on that agricultural infrastructure. And, Mr. Chairman, at the appropriate time, we'd like to conduct a presentation of that program. I think you'd be very interested in seeing what they have come up with. Our next step in that program actually is to contract with the University of Oregon to refine and enhance that program, test it, make sure it works, make sure we're asking the right questions and we're getting the kind of information that we want to get. So we're looking forward to the completion of that program. Our final concern would be the 20-year buildable supply issue. That comes up every year. There always is concern that Farm Bureau is going to introduce another bill that would eliminate the 20-year requirement. We'd probably like to do that, but in fact we're not going to do that this year. But many believe that our land use planning system is a farmland protection system. That's what you hear when you talk to people. That's what they think it does. But with the 20-year buildable supply requirement, and now proposals to expand what's included in that, I would suggest to you that we don't have a farmland protection program. What we have is a farmland conversion program. So I would close today with the question, where is agriculture's 20-year land supply? Every time there's a change in the land use planning system as it relates to urban growth boundaries, part of our supply disappears. So I'll just leave you with that question. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thanks for the opportunity to come before you today.
Thank you, Don. And I, again, apologize for having to get the Reader's Digest version this morning. Any questions from the committee? Representative?
Yes, the witness. Just would you then view the urban growth boundary as a no-growth boundary? That is, the line by which industrial commercial growth would be limited by cities and municipalities, counties?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, not necessarily no. In some cases, maybe yes, where that is surrounded by our very best farmland, if that urban growth boundary is surrounded by that. you hate to say no growth, but you need to be careful. At some point, given how big is that agricultural community and what is the agricultural infrastructure that supports that community, and at what point does that infrastructure break down to the point that it disappears, leaving the remaining agricultural people at a very distinct disadvantage. On the other hand, other cities they have exception areas around them. They have rural residential areas, areas other than EFU that could be expanded into, at least to begin with.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Ron Eber, DLCD. Is he here? Okay, well, I have Bob. Yeah, Bob, come on up here.
Good Mr. Morning. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Bob Rindy. I'm the legislative coordinator for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I apologize that Mr. Randy Franke, who is the chair of LCDC, was going to be here, and I think he's probably going to arrive too late to give this. So I will try to fill in as best we can. With me is Ron Eber, who's our farm and forest lands specialist, and who will also be, you will also see during this session quite a bit, because there are usually many bills or other discussions involving our farm and forest land program. Department of Land Conservation and Development is led by a 7-member commission, Land Conservation and Development Commission, or LCDC, as many of you have heard. That includes local officials and other officials, and is made up of lay citizens from various areas in the state, according to a fairly complex statute, actually, as to where they must be from and how long they serve. The statewide land use program was adopted in 1973, and primarily to conserve farm and forest land, ocean and coastal resources, and to manage urban growth. And it did that by promulgating comprehensive land use plans for all cities and counties, and by the adoption of 19 statewide planning goals that cover issues all the way from citizen involvement, economic development, affordable housing, transportation, and coastal and ocean issues. The program by 1985 resulted in local land use plans for all cities and counties that were acknowledged by LCDC to be in compliance with those 19 statewide planning goals. That process essentially, I think, illustrates that this is a program where the state and local governments share both the goals that are now part of each of those plans, and the implementation of those goals, such as the protection of farm and forest land, which I think you'll hear a lot about, or urban growth boundaries, those goals coming from the state. The state doesn't itself issue any permits. We don't, LCDC or DLCD, don't issue any permits. We simply make sure that the local plans remain in compliance with the goals. And there's two ways that that happens. First, as all local land use plans are amended, and there are probably thousands of amendments or other local land use decisions every year, those decisions may be appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals, or LUBA, if a citizen, or in only about 10 cases a year, our department, believes that the amendments would violate a statewide goal or statute. But the second process we call periodic review, and under that process, on a schedule from about 5 to 15 years, all the local land use plans in the state are updated or amended. In fact, that would probably occur without the periodic review process, but under that process, the state may require that the plans be amended to contain new provisions, especially new statutes, and there are a number of new statutes every year, as well as any changes that LCDC has made to the goals, usually through administrative rules. There are a couple of key provisions that I think you'll be probably focusing on a lot, at least that's the case in past legislative sessions, so I wanted to go through those briefly with you. Urban growth boundaries, an urban growth boundary, or UGB will be the acronym you'll hear, surrounds each of Oregon's 240 cities and includes a 20-year supply of land. That 20-year supply of land is to be vacant or developable, or it could be redevelopment or infill, but is to accommodate a very long-term growth projection made by the local government. And inside that boundary, the idea of the program, of course, is that that's where the urban growth in the state will go, and our goals and rules are intended to assure that there is affordable housing and that there is commercial and industrial development potential and a variety of other necessary procedures for urban growth to take place in the state. Outside of urban growth boundaries, we have about three categories of land. Exclusive farm use zoning applied to farmland throughout the state, and that changes depending on the quality of the land and whether you're east or west of the mountains. And that generally assures that land is in farming, but also, as Mr. Schoenberg just talked to you about, there are a variety of other uses allowed in farm areas. Forest land zoning is similarly intended to assure that the primary use of that land is for forestry, and both the farm and the forest provisions generally accomplish that through minimum lot sizes that are large enough to assure that it, indeed what you have is resource use and not residential use.
Mr. Rainey, let me ask a question relating to maintaining the land for agricultural use. In Southern Oregon, we see that the land has been maintained, but we've seen a significant loss in land that's actually in farming. And so we see land protected, but basically purchased by those that have the money to build large homes, and the actual farming of land in smaller plots seems to have is diminishing. Do you feel, is that the case, and can you tell me why that might be happening?
Yeah, I was going to, Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I was going to go into the third category, which I think is what you're describing in large part, and that is that there's, Ron will have to tell you the number, but there are a couple of million of acres rural and statewide that are in what we call exceptions, generally in residential use. An awful lot of that land was in residential use before the program came into effect, even though it may be built on farmland. And generally, it's from 1 to 5 to 10 acre parcels. And so that, in some of the areas that you're seeing, that you're describing, are sanctioned, allowed by the plan, and have been allowed by LCDC. However, there is the farm and forest protection zones allow a variety of dwellings, and usually it's houses that are for farming or for forestry, but other uses as well on farmland and forest land statewide. And the parcel sizes vary considerably from county to county. The state cannot in any way demand or in any other way enforce something to make sure that a house built on farmland is only for agriculture, except through the provisions that I described. Large minimum lot size, you get a farmhouse. If someone wants to move out to a farm, buy a 40 or 80 acre piece of farmland and put a mansion on it, it's not up to us to stop that practice. So that's another thing that you see, and maybe also causing the pattern that you're describing. Finally, there are a variety of other kinds of homes that can be built on farmland for farm help dwelling and things of that nature. Did you want to add anything, Ron, to that situation?
Bob, Ron, thank you very much. I'm sorry, we've got to get going on the public hearing, but I know we'll be seeing you often, and look forward to your coming back where we have a little more time to address the issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only other thing that I didn't get to, and I would be happy to come back and tell you about it, is the work we did in the interim with the Committee on Commercial and Industrial Land. and they have made a number of recommendations. Those will be arriving in all of your mailboxes soon, and those are recommendations that we believe we should be trying to implement with regard to more market-ready industrial sites statewide. So at some point, we would at least either probably we can do this in writing or come back up and give you some details there. They're new and exciting, and I think a lot of people will be asking us and you to discuss them.
I think that's an important dialogue the committee needs to hear from you, Bob. So we'll look forward to your coming back. Again, my apologies for having to kind of rush things through this morning.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I can also put a marker on a future discussion, it would be very interesting for me to have some briefing, which could be in private, on how you make the decisions on a plan that comes to you from something like Metro. You've recently just gotten a Metro plan, and I'd be interested in a review of how that process works. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bob. We're closing the informational portion of our meeting, and as promised, we are opening the public hearing on House Bill 2137. Representative Close. I think one of the important things the committee needs to know is that there are some people in this building that spent an awful lot of time dealing with this issue, and we hope to hear from those people to help us as we go through on this bill. Representative Close, it's indeed an honor to have you here today.
Well, thank you, Chair Garrard, members of the Environment and Land Use Committee. Good to be with you today. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you regarding land use reform. We did have a committee last session that did extensive work in this area. During the past interim, I was co-chair of the Joint Natural Resources Committee. Senator Ferrioli was co-chair with me. And the Joint Committee held a land use hearing day and voted out House Bill 2137 as a committee bill. Much of the writing of this bill came out of testimony and amendments that were offered in the 2001 session before the Land Use and Regulatory Fairness Committee, which was chaired by Representative Williams. And he did a fantastic job of attacking this issue with zeal. We were not able to come up with legislation at that time. And this was the committee that was to implement Measure 7, which was a ballot measure passed in November 2000. Senator Ferrioli and I took what we considered to be the best of that testimony that came out of that committee to produce House Bill 2137. The main portions of the bill are as follows. Section 2 deals with definitions. Section 3 talks about a 10% reduction of fair market value that would kick in the compensation part of the bill. Instances when the act would not apply, such as federal regulations in various areas. Section 4 deals with process for the right to compensation. And as you remember, a lot of the discussion around Measure 7 dealt with the cash compensation. Where would the cash come from? We had extensive testimony about alternatives to cash. So Section 5 lists some of those alternatives that the local governments could offer. And they're things like variances, property tax abatement, the reduction of system development charges, credits, transfer of development rights, and finally, condemnation. Section 6 and 7 deal with under what conditions a house could be built. Zoning laws largely remain in effect, and also about partitioning. That's the guts of the bill, if you will, and we also know that those two sections probably need some work and would need to have some amendments in them to satisfy many of the people that have concerns with that area, and we're open to that. I appreciate very much your willingness to hear this important bill. As you know, Measure 7 was passed by a large majority of voters who wanted to bring more fairness into the land use system. It was thrown out by the courts using the double subject argument, but the content of Measure 7 was never questioned in the courts. So I believe it's up to us, the legislature, and the elected representatives of the people to carry on this important reform that the people started. I believe we have a mandate to produce a fairer, more just land use system, and I welcome the partnership of this committee in this important effort for Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions for Representative Close? Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, Chair and Representative Close. I have just a series of questions. Did the Joint Committee or have you individually before testifying this morning attempted to identify the fiscal impact of this measure if it was fully enacted?
Chair Garrard, Representative Ackerman, we have not gone to legislative fiscal at this point because, as you see in Section 5, there's alternatives to cash, so it would be difficult to ascertain what the fiscal would be. It could be zero. We just have no way of knowing. But, of course, that would be part of the process of this bill, that you would get a fiscal from legislative fiscal on it.
Have you consulted with any counties or cities with respect to their positions on this bill, particularly considering the financial consequences?
Chair Garrard, Representative Ackerman, we had those people come before the Land Use Regulatory Fairness Committee. We had, I believe, Deschutes County particularly was involved. The Linn County Commissioners from my district were involved. The Linn County Commissioners are aware of this bill and are largely supporting it. So, at least in my district, there has been quite a bit of work done.
Are you saying that there are municipalities or cities which are supporting the bill in the present form?
Well, I can only speak for my own district, Representative Ackerman and Chair Gordon.
And what would that position be?
Excuse me?
Well, you said you could speak for the people in your district. Are
no.
you saying that the city of Albany or the city of Linn or the county of Linn are in support of this bill as it stands?
Chair Garrard, Representative Ackerman, I'm speaking that my Linn County commissioners are aware of the bill and have expressed support to me. The commissioners.
Expressed support in what fashion? I mean, a resolution, a discussion with you? Do you have a letter you can show me?
Representative Garrard, Representative Ackerman, we have discussed it casually when we did the work on this bill. There's no resolution at this point because the bill has not yet been passed out or had hearings.
Okay. You mentioned that the impact could be zero, particularly if all your non-cash alternatives, I suppose, were exercised. Has your committee or have you done any work to determine what the potential liability would be if people sought cash awards instead of alternative means of settling these cases?
Chair Garrard, Representative Ackerman, there is a process in the bill that goes through the circuit court. So it would be a court hearing with a jury trial. So they would have that opportunity then to ask for compensation and what type of compensation the judge then would be making that determination.
My question was different. My question was, did the Joint Committee or have you individually attempt to determine what the total amount of cash awards might be if persons opted for the court process? What would be the extent of the awards, either countywide or statewide, fiscally?
Chair Garrard, Representative Ackerman, as I said, that can't be determined until that goes through a process through legislative fiscal, because we don't know how many people would ask for cash. But I can tell you that we had hearings before the committee where people came time and again, landowners came and said, we do not want cash. We want a fair system where we can have some chance to use our land. Not a single person came before Representative Williams' committee and said, we want cash. Not a one.
Would you then support an amendment which would eliminate the cash award and just limit the measure to non-cash considerations if there's been a public taking of more than 10%?
Chair Garrard, Representative Ackerman, that would be up to this committee and the body. I personally think that we need the cash alternative. I think there may be cases where it is something that people will ask for, particularly if they are elderly and no longer could build, whatever the situation may be. I think we need that alternative.
Were there any fiscal estimates in
Representative Ackerman, how many more questions do you have?
A lot. Give me three more.
Three more? That's fine.
when Measure 7 was on the ballot, Representative, were there any fiscal impacts as part of the ballot measure or a part of the ballot explanation? And what were those fiscal impacts?
Chair Harrod, Representative Ackerman, you would have to deal with the drafters of that initiative. I was not involved with that. I remember reading it over, but I do not recall. It's been several years. I don't recall the specifics. But the drafters could tell you, I'm sure.
Would $7 billion be a reasonable, that refresh your memory as a reasonable figure?
Chair Harrod, Representative Ackerman, again, we've offered alternatives in this bill, so I don't believe $7 billion is an accurate figure concerning this legislation.
Can you conceive under certain circumstances, Representative, that a owner of land who would be subject to this act might also achieve appreciation of his or her property as a result of land use regulations? Is that conceivable?
Chair Gerard, Representative Ackerman, that probably is conceivable, but I feel comfortable with it in a circuit court jury situation with a judge that there would be fairness and you would not have that type of thing going on.
Okay. But in fairness to the fiscal coffers of the potential defendants, would that not be reasonable to submit to the court as an offset or the jury as an offset against an award of this nature the appreciated value of the subject property? Would you support an amendment of that nature?
Chair Gerard, Representative Ackerman, I think that's an interesting idea, and I think that you should pursue that.
Thank you very much, Representative Ackerman.
I do have an amendment to that effect, Mr. Chair. We can discuss that when it's drafted.
Great. We'll look forward to it.
Thank you.
Your prowess as an attorney is impressive. Are there any other questions for Representative Close? Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
We do have Representative Williams also scheduled around 9:30, somewhere around that time. So, and we have a very impressive list of those who wish to speak this morning and about an hour to try to get into all of this. But I would certainly let all of you know that this committee intends to proceed with this issue in a very deliberate fashion, to explore every detail and ramification involved with 2137 and what some of us are already calling the son of seven. So at this point, until Representative Williams arrives, I'll go to the list for those of you that have signed up for public testimony. Is that Kennedy?
Kennedy?
Cliff Kennedy? Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thank you for giving me this opportunity. I am Cliff Kennedy, a recently retired farmer from Benton County, just outside the city of Albany. I am a 30-year advocate for land use planning, which has been one of the best things we farmers have had going for us. I request that you oppose this bill as it is now written. If you amend it to provide for appropriate and adequate funding, I will support it. It is understandable that some people feel they are being treated unfairly by not being permitted to sell their land for development, while others are permitted to sell for development and pocket obscene profits from land conversion. It is not fair to the community for land speculators, who do nothing, to be able to walk away with immense profits and leave the cost of growth to the community. In the end, these costs are reflected in the high cost of housing. I am not talking about developers. I am talking about windfall profits from land conversions, also known as speculative profits. It is my opinion that this problem could be solved and laid to rest by taxing the windfall profits from land conversions from farmland to development land at almost 100%. Not 100, but at almost 100. 95% would be in the ballpark. Such a tax would provide funds to compensate for legitimate takings complaints as well as to pay for infrastructures required for growth. This might also resolve the question of system development charges. With such funding provisions, I could be an enthusiastic supporter of this bill.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Kennedy, would you respond to a question?
Sure.
Try. Representative Ackerman.
Merely a statement. I just want to thank the witness for his fiscal foresight. Sir, you have more courage than most legislators, because I think you're basically saying, don't fund it unless you've got money for it. We don't think that way up here. We think in terms of legislative mandates which are unfunded, and that's what's contributed to our fiscal difficulties. I think your sense of fiscal conservatism is responsible, and it was just a pleasure to hear you say that here this morning. Thank you.
Thank you for your affirmation.
Are there any other questions? Thank you again, Mr. Kennedy. Liz Frankel. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Liz Frankel, and I am here today representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I am their Natural Resources Action Coordinator. My apologies. I will turn it in later today, the signed testimony. Our staff was not working yesterday, and so I went to pick it up this morning, and it wasn't there. The League, as you probably know, has had a long, long interest in land use planning. We've been involved from the very beginning. We feel very strongly about support for this Oregon statewide land use planning program and for the protection of the health, welfare, and safety of Oregon citizens. When we testified during the last session before Representative Williams' committee, we supported the principles that were developed by the Speaker of the House: maintain the integrity of Oregon's land use planning program, clarification of the issues, and public participation. We suggested at that time there be an additional one, and that is identifying revenue sources required to pay for qualifying claims. Many of the issues that were addressed in that committee, which dissolved for lack of agreement, are before you in this bill. And our questions still lack agreement. And that is, what is the acceptable loss of market value of property? Whether local jurisdictions or regional framework plans should be preempted? Who should make the determination as to decrease in market value, as well as who should pay and how much? Additional issues that we see raised are reasonable investment-backed expectations. What is that? How is agriculture or forest land protected against non-agricultural or forest uses when housing is blanketly defined as a reasonable use of all private property? And finally, are statewide planning goals preempted by this law? As the rule, the bill is now written, we believe that it is in opposition to the statewide land use planning program. We urge your opposition, as well as an affirmation of support for the land use program. Thank you for this opportunity to express our views, and we ask that our testimony be made a part of the record. And I apologize for not having written copies for you all.
So we'll get them later. Frankel, thank you. Any questions of Ms. Frankel? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Ms. Frankel, I appreciate your being here today. I just had a question which you may or may not want to answer this morning, but clearly what's motivating this bill in part is the passage of a ballot measure that the courts have thrown out for procedural reasons, and it seems to me there are a number of significant issues that have been addressed in the same way by the courts that the legislature hasn't necessarily acted on, and what comes to mind would be everything from campaign finance reform to term limits. I'm curious if you have thoughts as a LEAK member on what the appropriate role of the legislature is in a situation such as this.
I think that probably, and at this point I'm erring and straying from League of Women Voters' official position. I'll give you my opinion. My opinion is that the legislature does have a role. I think they have a role in, as they have had in all of the land use planning statutes that we now have, and we have a huge variety of them. My big concern, as I expressed, and it's the revenue question, and it's the unfortunate attribute of if you, Representative Close made the statement that a lot of people didn't want the financial claim paid. I mean, that wasn't their goal. Our concern is that a lot of people, really, their goal is to get rid of all regulation. And as we all know, as the Farm Bureau is defended, DLCD is defended, this was passed with a purpose. And we all know, like, the purpose of saving lives on highways, there are rules, and they're there for a purpose. Our concern is that many counties and cities, in the face of inability to pay, will choose all kinds of alternatives to avoid enforcing. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Representative Greenleck.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Ms. Frankel.
Thank you.
I'd like to follow up on a direction Representative Ackerman was taking in his questioning of Representative Close. I too have an amendment. We haven't had a chance to talk to work it out. On the fairness issue, I mean, it seems to me there are a lot of definitions of fairness, and if we define fairness as compensating a property owner when the action of the government diminishes the value of their property, then fairness would also say that when action of a government increases the value of a property, that the landowner ought to share that increase in profit with the government. And I will have a proposal to suggest a way to share, say, two-thirds of that value of increase if this passes with the government that made that increase happen. Do you think League of Women Voters would support that definition of fairness?
Probably, but I think there's a real problem. And the problem comes just as there's kind of a difficulty in talking about reasonable investment-backed expectation and how you're going to put a dollar value on that. Increased value often has, it's very difficult to make a determination about that as well.
Yeah, that's kind of a mystical, as is decrease in value. But if we're talking about being fair, we ought to have fairness. Fairness should define that in both directions.
It depends on what your goal is. Is your goal to make everybody happy? No.
No.
If your goal is to protect farm and forest land, coastal resources, all, even make ensure that we have adequate supply of urban land, then that goal, probably there are going to be some people that don't like the answers. So, fairness is in the eyes of the beholder. It depends on what your goal is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Ms. Frankel.
Ms. Frankel, very much for coming in your testimony this morning. As I mentioned, there are a lot of people in this building that have spent a great deal of time, effort, and a certain amount of their own blood in dealing with this issue. One such man who we welcome here this morning is Representative Max Williams.
Thank you.
Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the chairman's invitation yesterday for me to come and chat with you just briefly about this subject. It's a subject that I have a little experience with from last session. And as you're already experiencing, I'm sure through the testimony today, you're becoming, I think, aware, if you weren't already, and I'm sure you were, that this is an extremely complicated, complicated area. We spent through a special committee a great portion of the last legislative session attempting to address through a bill which would have essentially been a compromise bill the issue that was raised by the passage of Measure 7. And I won't take you through the long history of where we started and where we ended up and why things didn't eventually come to fruition. As you well know, the court, having deemed Measure 7 unconstitutional, sort of reset the clock on the entire issue, and I think that's one of the reasons that you have House Bill 2137 in front of you. I will simply give you just a couple of issues to think about. There is no question in my mind that Measure 7 or a Measure 7-like proposal would pass if asked to be voted on again by the people, because there is, I think, a sense, a general sense, and I think the evidence from the work that was done by various focus groups and the like bore out after the passage of Measure 7 that there is a sense that the system operates currently in a manner that is unfair to property owners, that by regulation, by administrative rule, by fiat of a city council or the like, that or by the state land use planning system as it currently operates and is mandated then to be implemented by counties and local governments, that there can in fact be substantial economic negative impact to a person's property as a result of those regulations. That being said, I think that the fairness issue does, in fact, run both ways. To the extent that we want to have a comprehensive, balanced land use system that protects agricultural land, farm and forest land, and appropriately designates land for appropriate development as the state grows and our communities grow, there is positives that come from that system that do appreciate, essentially, to neighboring landowners, to landowners in general, and to citizens in general. And striking that balance between those two competing fairness components would be the challenge that you have as you consider what House Bill 2137 attempts to do. I will give you an example, I think, of what I at least consider to be one of the supreme complexities of this issue. If you're to take someone who has property outside an urban growth boundary that when they purchased it at some period of time, maybe in the 50s or the 60s, could have at that point, had they chosen to, subdivided with very little government regulation and built houses on it, and had always perhaps intended to do so. If you take that person today and you say that based on the fact that there was a time when you could have done that and you can no longer do that because of statewide land use policy, we're going to compensate you for the value of land that you could have subdivided had you chosen to do so at a time prior to the imposition of those regulations, but a rule that occurred after you purchased the property. How do you economically figure out what the value of that property is? And how do you do it in the abstract? One of the most serious challenges we had as we attempted to deal with this issue was first trying to figure out how much land we were really talking about, how many landowners had really been negatively impacted, but also how you would actually appraise on a situation like that, and whether you could actually determine, was it the value at the time that they could have done it? Was it the current value now that they had chosen to do it? And if you were to isolate a 5 or a 10 or a 20 or a 50-acre parcel in some area outside an urban growth boundary and say, well, this is the place that these people have filed a claim because they've chosen not to continue to farm or whatever else they can't do economically on the property now and they want to subdivide. How do you assume that if everybody else had been given the opportunity to subdivide their property and were without that regulation, that these people 5 miles out of the urban growth boundary or 3 miles out of the urban growth boundary, would have ever had an economic ability to do that because all their neighbors might have done it ahead of them. You understand the complexity here. It's figuring out what the economic impact is to an individual landowner in an isolated instance is an extremely complicated economic model, and is extremely challenging to determine. It's not as simple as simply anyone who wants to can go out and have someone else say, well, look, their subdivision closer in with, you know, better street access got this, but, you know, the neighbors might have developed down the road as well had they been given the opportunity. And certainly not every piece of ground, if subdivided, would have been able to support any kind of development on it. And so how do you factor those in as you try to address what balance and fairness actually means in this instance? We attempted to do that in a version of a bill that obviously didn't move through the last legislative session. And we did it in a lot of rough sort of ways that would have allowed for evaluation at a regional level and to place essentially through something that the legislature wouldn't do but a group after the legislature would have done, some general values by region as you tried to make these kinds of determinations. It was far from a perfect model by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it would be impossible to construct a perfect model to actually address these issues. And that gets to the question of the more philosophical question of what is this balance? And I notice in this bill, for example, on the going forward portion of the bill, it's a 10% rule, that if it's impacted the property value by more than 10%, then it triggers either the right to compensation or essentially a waivable situation, which is something that we weren't frankly able to do in the bill that we were working on before because of Governor Kitzhaber's announced opposition to any approach to waiver. It's certainly an option that this committee can look at, and I certainly don't have any clue as to whether the new governor is going to be any more or any less inclined to address the issue of waiver of land use policy, but recognize again that it's an extremely complicated situation to allow essentially waivers without some limitation on the qualifications in which they would be allowed. I'm not here to suggest that I don't think that that ought to be part of whatever approach would go forward, but at the same time I think it's an extremely complicated area with serious long-term implications for our land use policy as it's existed for the last 30 plus years. I will be the first to say that I believe that the pendulum has at times swung too far. That regulation and the inability of the property owner to actually accomplish some appropriate goal with their property has been too impeded in this system, that it has become difficult, if not sometimes almost impossible, for the average person to walk in and try to accomplish something with their property. And I've made that real clear to both local and statewide agencies that I thought that their obligation was not just to stand behind the counter and say no. Their obligation was to stand behind the counter and say, no, maybe not as you've got it designed, but here are three or four alternatives where you could do something with your property. And yet many, I think, feel like they're not under any obligation, perhaps under an obligation not to provide that kind of advice. And I think that back pressure on this issue is much as what's fueled this movement and the concerns about fairness within the land use system. With those sort of overall comments and my best wishes to you in this effort through the remainder of the legislative session, I would encourage you to move carefully. I would encourage you to consult as many of the experts in the subject matters as possible, be they in areas of appraisal, be they in areas of long-term land use policy. There are plenty of people who can show you studies about the potential impacts. And I'll also tell you that if you embark on a system that would compensate not only in a moving forward environment from November 7th of 2000, but if you also include, as this bill does, some looking back proposal to address people either by granting them lots of record or the ability to develop their property, and if they can't, then they have to be compensated for it. You need to consider how we intend to pay for that. The estimates we had were quite frankly all over the board in the last legislative session, but it's my own personal opinion based on only sort of the experience and the data that I saw in the last legislative session that were we to actually go back and begin to compensate people for the impacts of the statewide land use policy over the last 30 years, that it would be a fund that would need to be, I believe, in the billions of dollars in order to make that happen. Now, that argument cuts both ways. It does cut both ways. It can be used to say we can't afford it, but it also can be used to substantiate the fact that there has been substantial economic impact on many property owners through the state, throughout the state, as a result of the implementation of a statewide land use policy that I really do believe at the beginning intended to have a compensation function for people's property who have been impacted. And I do believe that based on the initial testimony and how the bill came into being in the first place. I think the problem is they ran into the same roadblock that I ran into and that I suspect to a degree you will run into, which is it's easy to say that there ought to be that system. It is much, much, much more difficult, complicated, and expensive to figure out how to construct it. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Williams. Attorney on attorney, I have no problem with. Representative Ackerman.
I only waved my hand this much. That's three questions. This is six.
And where was the hand, Representative?
It
was here.
Mr. Chair and Representative Williams, of course, we're all interested in many features of this bill, and the financial impact is one of increasing importance to me, considering our financial circumstances. In the work that you've done with the committee, could you give us the financial impacts that you have seen from basically high to low? And I realize we can't get a handle on it, but I just want to get an idea of the breadth of it.
Well, I don't know that we ever got what I would consider to be reliable evidence on the financial impact. We embarked at the beginning of the last legislative session when we began to address this issue in probably the first most serious attempt to identify the number of parcels that actually existed out there that were still under the same ownership prior to the adoption of land use planning in the late 60s, early 70s, that were still under the continuous ownership that would have been able to have been applicable for some sort of retroactive payment or compensation. We worked with the counties, we worked with the state offices as well, and did develop some pretty good mapping data using GIS systems. The title companies came forward with records, which we were able to sort of correlate and run those records against county data, and came up with a fairly rough estimate of the number of parcels that we thought would likely be impacted. And I say it was fairly rough because there isn't any sole source of this data. We had a lot of the county planning folks involved who were able on a sort of county-by-county basis to be able to provide us, given their comprehensive plan, the properties that they thought were affected. And so we did come up with some rough numbers as to the number of lots or parcels on a per-county basis that were impacted. And remember that each of these comprehensive plans were adopted by counties over a different period of time. And so the rule wouldn't necessarily apply in the same time frame, wouldn't necessarily apply in every county, but it would be over a course of time. And in fact, the famous story of comprehensive plans, which I learned actually through this process, but apparently is legend from the county that the chair of your committee now represents, was that the date that they were to fax in their or send in their comprehensive plan, it was apparently, and this may be apocryphal or it may be true, Representative, and you'll have to tell me, but it was the fax of that famous cartoon of the mouse sort of giving the one finger wave to a eagle as it was sort of sailing down towards it. And I don't know whether or not that was in fact true, but there was a varying period of time as to when those comprehensive plans were actually adopted and approved, and that changed it. So that's a long way of saying, Representative Ackerman, that we had only sort of the vaguest notions of what an impact on it, and it would depend on how you structured it. It would also depend on, you know, were you talking just a lot of record compensation, or were you talking compensation on the ability to subdivide? And if you were talking on the ability to subdivide, were you going to limit it to a certain number of subdivisions on a parcel, or is it going to be all of them? And were you going to include simply people who were in sort of a residential situation with their property, or were you going to include an impact on farm forest land, which, you know, would include you know, more industrial-oriented forest lands. And so depending on how that's structured, the swing would be substantial. I believe if only limited to residential, and if you cap the number of subdivisions at six, as this bill does, or something there about, you would still be looking overall, all counties included, at something in excess of a billion plus in the kind of financial impact. And I'll tell you, there are probably people behind me who would disagree with me about that estimate, and I don't know that anybody really knows the answer. And I'm totally willing to admit that I might be wrong on that, but it's just rough numbers as we were trying to work through this. All of that information is still available, and I would be happy to crate and have crated up all of that material and deliver it to the chair of the committee at my earliest convenience.
I can confirm, Representative, having been a Klamath County Commissioner, that I can confirm that story to you.
Okay.
So,
thank you.
Maybe some more questions, Mr. Chair. Representative Williams, in view of your statement that the financial impact cannot be ascertained, but perhaps could be a billion, maybe more, maybe not, would it be bad public policy for us to pass this legislation without knowing the full financial impacts and without providing for funds for to meet that impact?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, it was my belief as we began in the last legislative session to address this issue that, and I think over time, you know, I mean, in the end, it killed us anyway, and so maybe we should have just killed ourselves sooner rather than later. But I was fully of the belief that if we started talking about the issue of how to pay for it right out of the gate, we would have never gotten through many of the substantive and procedural issues that I thought we were going to need to tackle. In other words, if we started first with the money issue, we would high center on that one right out of the door. And so what I had hoped was that we would be able to come to some consensus on the difficult policy issues that this issue presents. And at the end, because of our overwhelming unanimity on how we would solve that issue, we would somehow sail into the sea of agreement on the financial side of this point. I was wrong about that from a number of different angles. But I had always intended and still believe, in my own opinion, that you cannot have this discussion and not only just based on our current economic situation, which obviously exacerbates the situation, but I have always believed that you cannot have this discussion legitimately without having a discussion about, to the extent there would be compensation, where is that going to come from? And if the answer is you're not going to compensate and you don't intend to answer the issue of compensation, then I think we ought to just have the argument be not about compensation but simply about the right to waiver, because I think if you don't have the discussion about where the money will come from a compensation perspective, then you are simply limited to the issue of local governments being given the opportunity, and the state government, given the situation, being given the opportunity to waive the land use regulation. And that's a completely different argument. If you're going to talk about compensating, then I think you have to also talk about where the resources come. And I'm not saying that waiver ought not to be a component of that conversation, but it can't solely be the conversation, because I think you've got to talk about the money issue. It's too much. It would be too impacting, not only to the state budget, but to local government. And don't forget that many of the local governments who have implemented this have implemented it as a result of state regulation. That being said, there was a lot of finger-pointing between the local and state government entities about who would bear the ultimate burden and responsibility for the financial impact of this issue. And so counties and cities are not going to sit idly by and have the financial responsibility for state land use policy shunted to them. And we had actual proposals and discussions, and there was even language in the bill that would approach how you would mediate this dispute as to whether it was a county or a city or the state that would have to pay for the issue. And that was based on whether it was a state mandate or something that they had passed locally.
Did I get one more?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, because the answers are exceeding the questions in volume. So
I apologize.
That's the briefing.
As you will find, most of the answers to the questions raised by this issue exceed in volume.
Representative Williams, and the overall fairness issue to the property owner and to the public entity that would be involved in litigation of this nature, wouldn't it be reasonable to provide as an offset in the compensation process an offset that would be calculated based upon the appreciated value of the property, based upon land use regulations, and you would offset that against the loss in value in order to come to a fairer price for the partial taking of the real property? Would you support such a notion?
Yes.
I know when to stop asking questions,
and I know when to start. I know when to stop answering them too, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
A great display of again our legal system. I would like to ask a question, Representative. Was there did the committee reach any kind of a conclusion when it comes down to the ultimate responsibility of a land taking or a change, etc.? Did it ultimately, when you follow the trail, come back to the federal government or local governments?
Mr. Chairman, as again with almost every issue here, there was no simple answer to that question. The intent of Measure 7 and the assumption that the committee worked on, and I say the intent, my belief of the intent and the way that it was written, and the approach I think that the committee and the folks who talked about this issue through most of the last session took, was that to the extent that there was a mandate that was a federal mandate, it would not result in compensation. In other words, to the extent that the state was operating or a local government was operating by a mandate from the federal government on some particular issue, be it ESA or something else, that it would not result in the ability for an individual to be compensated under the plan. The challenge, again, if I could, Mr. Chairman, however, is how do you exactly know when an agency is acting under a federal mandate or based on something which is of their own design or on some state mandate that may mirror in some respects but not in its entirety some other federal mandate that's been placed upon us with respect to land use or environmental policies. So there was, again, in the draft version of the bill, a process, as I recall, or at least in one or two of the versions of the bill, a process by which that would be worked out and challenged. I think there was maybe a legal standard that we had tried to develop, but the issue was certainly acknowledged, and there was a recognition that anything that you did would have to let you off the hook for stuff that was federally required, but at the same time make sure that people weren't hiding behind, you know, a general federal pronouncement with specific, you know, regulation that was in fact of their own doing. And again, there was no easy answer to that. It was going to have to be some sort of a balancing approach in the bill, ultimately left up to a court to probably have to make that decision.
Any other questions of Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Max, how many parcels? Did you ever come up with a number that were affected?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, at one stage at the end of the negotiations as that was going on, I believe that there was even a version that had the number of parcels set at 10. But again, it was limited. It was sort of more limited on the front end, as I recall. But the number, but if you got in on the front end, you could go up to 10 parcels. That was at least at one stage. I confess that I honestly don't keep a copy of this by my bedside table, and so I didn't go back and read the -14 or 15 or 16 or 17 amendments to the bill that was in the last session to get a sense of where we ended up. But I want to say that I thought at one point there was at least 10 parcels sort of on the table, but recognize that that number was achieved in part by, you know, people giving other stuff up through the process of negotiation. So it didn't necessarily stand out there independent. It was a process of give and take that got us to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Williams, it seems to me, and I'm curious what your impression is, that the sense of urgency behind this issue that was present last session has died down to a great extent, and I don't know whether that was because of the thought that something would end up on the ballot again in the last election, and then that didn't happen. But it was suggested in our first hearing by John Chandler that maybe there could be another approach rather than trying to do these kinds of sweeping changes that might be creating some permanent commission that could look at updating the land use laws and where really egregious unfairness happened, that there would be sort of a pressure release valve built into state government. So I'm curious if you think there might be other approaches that we could look at and how that might work.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, I certainly do think that there are a real myriad of possible ways to address this issue. Your reference to a pressure release valve, I think, is an appropriate one, because I do think that there needs to be this fairness issue is real, and I want to, you know, it is defined to some degree like beauty in the eye of the beholder, but it is a real issue, and it's real in places like Multnomah County, just like it's real in places like Deschutes and Wheeler and Wasco and you know, Southern Oregon. It is a real issue, and I think that was shown, and I think it was surprised many people how real that issue was over and over again during these discussions. I would not suggest to you that because of our the emergency nature of our circumstances in the legislature with the budget issue, which may account to some degree for less attention being paid to this matter now than was in the last legislative session. But I don't believe that in the minds of most Oregonians that this issue is any less important now than it was. I think the sense that there needs to be fairness weaved into this system is one that is really up to us. And I will tell you that I do not believe that it ought to be done by initiative, and I have always said that. I think the issues involved in this subject are so complex that it is not an appropriate issue to be addressed by initiative, but it will be, Representative Rosenbaum. I believe with all my heart that it will be, and in a manner that would be, frankly, probably not what any of us would want had we had the opportunity and time to deliberate thoughtfully and develop the right solution for Oregonians. But if the legislature at some point fails to act generally on this subject matter and does not find the pressure release valve, as you've sort of described it, there will be some measure which comes through that is going to cut a broad swath without taking into account the complications that we briefly just touched on here in our discussion this morning, and that will occur. So it is incumbent upon us, even under our great circumstances of urgency, I think, to try to resolve this issue and to resolve it in a thoughtful way.
Representative Greenland.
Mr. Chair and Representative Williams, there are, it seems to me, two parts to this bill as I look at. One is the TAPE, the compensation bill, and I think section 6 and 7 talk about the ability to build homes, and in fact it looks like lots of homes outside of the land use planning laws. Did those two elements, were those two elements both in the deliberations that somewhere along the line that your committee last year went through, and does it seem proper to have them both in the same place in this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, yes, they were. We approached the issue in the last session, and again, if I was doing it again, and I'm not, but if I was doing it again, I would do it perhaps differently. But we really did break the issues down. There was really the retroactive issue, the issue of these people who have in fact actually been affected by 30 years of land use policy, who bought their property before these bills were put into place, and who have been deprived of their ability to do with their property as they thought they might have been able to do at the time of purchase. And that was a separate and distinct issue with a separate and distinct set of solutions from someone who goes out today and buys a piece of property that's currently regulated, and then a year from now a new regulation comes forward, and how we addressed the long-term going forward. And the issues really are quite distinct. governments can plan long term with a situation that isn't looking backward. If we impose on them a new obligation to compensate, they can incorporate that into their long term planning about how they're going to develop, how they're going to zone, how they're going to, you know, put environmental overlays or whatever you want to talk about. That can be a rational decision making process, knowing that if they do something, they may trigger the need to compensate and therefore need to reserve for it before they move forward. It's a very different set of circumstances and a very different problem than having to address a period of unfairness where the opportunity has not existed. And so the bill and the approach and the discussion and the dialogue addressed both those issues in the last legislative session and worked out essentially a separate set of solutions to try to address both of them. And again, far from universally supported, I think in the end it was me and... hold on a minute, let me think. No, it was just me, I think, that supported that.
It's lonely out there in the forefront of policy.
Yeah, right.
So that, if I may follow up, you might support breaking these issues into perhaps two separate measures so they can be independently,
Whether you break them into two separate measures or whether you keep them together, both issues, I think, have to be addressed to take the pressure out of the system that Representative Rosenbaum talked about. They could certainly fly in separate bills, and there would be reasons to do that, and there would be other reasons, some political and some not political, to keep everybody sort of at the table in the mix talking together by keeping them in the same bill. But, I think that's an issue that obviously the chair and the committee would have to address over time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Representative, whatever the ultimate result of this hearing, you and your committee's past efforts and hard work will certainly be a significant factor in finding the solution, and we thank you for that and bringing that to this committee this morning.
And I didn't hear the chair ask for those crates either.
keep your crates.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and they will always be available to you. When it's appropriate and when you want me to show you where they'll actually stick the dagger at various points in this process, I'd be happy to point that out to you as well.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
We intend to continue till 10:30 this morning, and we have about 20 people on the sign-up sheet. And again, I think this is such an important issue that we don't want to constrict anyone as far as what their feelings and what they have to say to us. So we'll just start down the list, and we'll go to 10:30, and then we will adjourn until Thursday morning at 8:30 and pick up the same issues and the same list if those people are available. So at this point, I'd like Ms. Lahan, the mayor of Wilsonville. Is she still here? Good morning, and thank you for coming.
I think I was further down the list than that.
Well, we try to honor our public officials and the fact that we know you. You have a busy schedule. So.
Okay. I appreciate the opportunity, Chair Girard and members of the committee, to speak before you on this today. My name is Charlotte Lehan. I've been the mayor of Wilsonville since 1997. And through much of the 90s, Wilsonville has been one of the fastest growing cities in Oregon. And while we don't, we didn't get that by actively encouraging growth, we do our best to accommodate good development as well. We work with developers to facilitate urbanization of our urban lands, the industrial, commercial, and residential. And we don't ever just say no at the counter. We work to provide alternatives for developers that have allowed Wilsonville to develop in the way that it has. And so with that as a background, I just want to raise some issues. Now I'm forgetting what I should do, because I did bring them with me today, but the issues that have been raised by my city attorney. Relative to this bill, and they are the impacts that it would have on local government, and our and some of the things that raise red flags, and I'll just go through them very generally, and you have it in a little bit more detail in my written testimony, but our concern is that this could sweep up a lot of things that are land use restrictions that the government does as a regular course of events. And just to say, from 2000 forward, from November of 2000 forward, in a fast-growing city like Wilsonville, we haven't been sitting still since 2000. So that's there's a lot that has gone on, and a lot that would be impacted just to go retroactive back that far. One of them are all the conditions of approval that have been applied to all development that's occurred since then. We have to consider those are a piece of a land use restriction. When every property we approve, every development we approve has conditions of approval that go with it, and all of those could be affected. We've updated, of course, all of our master plans since then, or most of them. Our water master plan, wastewater, stormwater collection, and we're just in the process of finalizing our transportation systems plan, and that's been a six-year effort. All of those things could be called into question by this, because they involve land use restrictions that are incorporated in those master plans. Unless building codes and structural codes are specifically exempted, our concern is that those would be caught up as well. We've passed sprinkler ordinances and things like that we have concerns over. And then the whole issue of SDCs, and I know that and how those are determined. And I know it's been mentioned here that local jurisdictions would have the opportunity to use non-cash remedies, but those non-cash remedies, if you're talking about tax abatements and SDC reductions, are still very real fiscal impacts for the local jurisdiction and for other developers. If you give SDC reductions to one property, then the rest of the properties that pay for that infrastructure will have to pick it up. So it's not free to just do those kinds of non-cash remedies. And the impacts are on the local community. I won't go through the rest of the ones that are there, but I just want to say that this was a very quick list that we came up with that is certainly not exhaustive. But one of the things is that the way our system works, a lot of what we do and a lot of the land use restrictions and approvals, conditions of approval, and that are a part of the local system are intended to move development forward and intended to provide the infrastructure so that and if you don't do that, if we don't have any way at the local level to provide the infrastructure, then what happens is we aren't able to maintain the quality of life, and we start getting a lot of pressure, especially in fast-growing communities, from the no-growth segment of the community that wants to stop things, and because they're unhappy because we're not doing the job we should in terms of keeping pace and concurrency with infrastructure. And so it's as Representative Williams was saying, it's extremely complicated, and it's very hard to make one change without it affecting a lot of others. I think that right now is a very poor time to move forward with this, given the fiscal situation at the state level and for local jurisdictions, because just as we look at the legal and administrative costs of putting together a bureaucracy to deal with a new compensation measure, that alone is something that would break local budgets, even if you never got to the actual compensation piece. And so without any funding source, I think this is ill-advised to go forward. And I would be happy to take any questions.
Motions. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Harlan Levy. It was suggested that the committee just go ahead and end the public hearing and take a vote this morning, but we decided we wouldn't do that. Good morning, Harlan.
Good morning, Chair Garrod, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Harlan Levy, staff attorney for the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'm here this morning to support the concepts contained in this bill. I do want to clarify for the record, there has been a rumor circulating around the building that this was one of our bills. I want to clarify for the committee, this is not a realtor bill. But we do support the concepts that are contained therein, specifically the idea that the land use system does need to be reformed. There are inequities and injustices that have affected so many people in the state that something really needs to happen. If we are going to continue being the leader in statewide land use planning, we really need to address some of the problems that Representative Williams alluded to so well in his testimony. His committee heard from people from all aspects of the state and all corners of the state that had been egregiously affected by some of the land use regulations that were many times mandated by the state, other times requirements of local city and county governments. Our concerns with this bill, with this specific House Bill 2137, are twofold. First of all, it does set up a compensation regime. And anytime you talk about a compensation regime, there has to be a funding source for that. And with the state budget situation the way that it is, we are worried about what that compensation regime might look like. So while we do want to address the inequities of the land use system, and we believe that is the reason Measure 7 passed, because so many people have been affected by the inequities, we are concerned with a focus primarily and significantly on compensation as opposed to addressing the regulatory reform that needs to take place. Second, we are a little concerned with Section 7 of the bill, which created a right to so-called right to subdivide. That would result in some unintended consequences in several areas of the state, and we would like to see any future product, any future bill to contain something other than that. We'd be happy to help this committee address this issue. We do believe that this issue needs to be addressed this legislative session because there will be ballot measures, there will be citizen activists, there will be initiatives coming forward that will bring this issue back. Measure 7, although the courts killed it on a procedural issue, is not dead. The reasons that it passes still exist. There are people out there. I hear from them on a weekly basis, sometimes on a daily basis. My members deal with them all the time that have been drastically affected by our land use system, where their property values have been significantly reduced and many times eliminated. With that, I know that there are other people that are signed up on the list. I don't want to take up too much of the committee's time this morning. I'd be happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Any questions for Mr. Levy?
I have one.
Representative Richardson.
People understand basic principles of the Constitution. Do you believe that the basic premise that public land, the private land should not be taken by the public without just compensation is what is at the essence of this bill?
Chair Girard, Representative Richardson, yes. The problem is, as you know, the courts have interpreted the takings clause as to require total deprivation of investment-backed expectations before they will award compensation for a regulatory taking. This bill goes at that by lowering the threshold by 90% from 100% deprivation to a 10% deprivation.
Okay, so is your position that if we do not deal with the underlying problem and we focus merely on technicalities, we're just going to face the wrath of the people as they express again the fact that they want us to hearken back to the constitutional principle?
Chair Girard, Representative Richardson, yes. That is our position.
Thank you.
Could I follow that?
Follow, Mr. Yeah. Representative Greenland.
On that same issue, did I hear you say that you thought the constitutional provision was covered at the 100% level, but that it's the degree of the level that provision ought to kick in that's at issue here?
Chair Girard, Representative Greenlick, we don't want to focus on the compensation issue. The issue of compensation should be the last resort. Frankly, we think the problem inherent in our land use system is that it is treating some people very unfairly. And those people don't necessarily want to receive a check from the government. They want to be allowed to utilize their land according to their reasonable investment-backed expectations.
But I'm understanding Representative Richardson to ask about the constitutional issue, and I thought I heard you say that that in the current system the constitutional requirement is covered. It's just triggered at the wrong level, is what I heard you say.
Chair Garrod, Representative Greenleaf, yes. If we're talking merely about compensation, which again would be the last resort here, the threshold that has been set by the courts is almost impossible to obtain in many cases. Those people that do obtain it spend so many years in court and so many thousands and thousands of dollars on lawyers' fees that governments know that they can push the envelope as far as they want because most people don't have the means to take it that far.
Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, Mr. Levy, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Art Schleck with the Association of Oregon Counties. Good morning, Art.
Good morning, sir. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Art Schleck. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm a policy manager, and I will say either I had the pleasure or at least the opportunity to work with Mr. Williams in committee during the last session on this matter. And in fact, a number of us started working right after it passed. So we spent about 8 months trying to figure out how to work this thing. What you're receiving is a document that was adopted by the Association of Oregon Counties on April 30th, 2001. And the document contains a set of principles that was, again, adopted by our association dealing with Measure 7. And I would submit to you that those principles are as applicable today as they were as we were looking at this issue almost 2 years ago. The principles are as follows, and I just hit those very briefly. The first one is that any solution should be clearly prospective in nature, and that's one of the issues that you've been hearing about today, whether the measure would be retroactive or whether it would be prospective. We're suggesting, or we believe, that it should be prospective in nature, and therefore the state or be it a local government, that you can look at the implications of any new regulations and you can ascertain potentially what the cost of those might be on individual property owners as well as on the community should they decide to go forward with those. Second one is accountability for adoption of property restrictions. We need to have it very clear as to what the accountability. I would just note for you that for counties, the bulk, and I would, when I say bulk, I would say somewhere between 80% to 90% of the regulations that counties have put in place that deal with lands outside urban growth boundaries are at the request or the requirements of either the legislature or administrative rules. Now, there will be some discussion about that, and there will be discussion about that in this manner, is that when counties submit their comprehensive plans or regulations for acknowledgement by the state, they will receive a back a response, well, I'm not sure we don't think we can approve that. Well, what can you approve? And you get into this discussion, and you get to some point where you offer a regulation that will pass mustard at the state level. The state can argue, well, we didn't require that. That was your choice. And so when we had these discussions about accountability and responsibility, you heard Representative Williams say it's not that easy, and it's not. Number three is compensatable acts must be reasonable and clearly defined. Number four, there should be a threshold for compensation. Number five, that the individual property owner and the community rights must be assured. There's a balance here between the rights to individuals and the rights of the community in terms of the environment, in terms of the community's ability to grow and to prosper. And number six, that the local decision-making process must be maintained. These principles, I would suggest to you, are principles that should be looked at, and that as we look at any piece of legislation, we would apply those as to whether we would support it or not. And so I think it's important at least to have those. The Association of Oregon Counties represents the 36 counties that are a partner with the state and cities in the statewide land use planning program. As I indicated to you, we participated in the various groups that worked on the takings issue in the 2001 session. I would submit to you that we are more than willing. Well, we're willing. I don't know about more than willing, based on the experience that we had. But we are willing, Mr. Chair, to participate in any kind of work group that you may form to continue to address this issue. And I think there are opportunities, as has been discussed by several of the representatives, to look at different components of this and maybe to separate some of the issues, like the lot of record issue that's been going on for 25 years as an issue, and it's just one of those, and maybe there's an opportunity to separate some of these issues to come up with a way of addressing in a reasonable way some of these components. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd answer questions if there are any.
Bob, I just automatically just looked to you now this morning.
Thank you.
There apparently are done, Art. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
I would want committee members also to know that if there is any person that you particularly wish to appear before this committee on this issue, please let the chair know, and we will make every effort to see that that person is here. And that's anyone that you'd like to testify. In that we're about 3 minutes from when we are going to adjourn, we will adjourn until Thursday morning, and we'll hopefully pick up right where we left off in our public hearing process on 2137. So I thank all of you, and I thank our committee this morning, and we'll see you Thursday morning at 8:30.